First of all, I would have, of course, like to say thank you for inviting me over and giving me some time to give a short presentation on the work that I've done and to give a review of what happened last weekend at the Brookhaven Lab, where there was actually a two-day workshop reviewing what is going on in flow physics and HPT, and where people presented most recent results, of which I'm going to show a few. So I have a rather broad topic to cover, but it gives me the chance to loosely throw in the newest results I've seen. The main objective that I'm going to follow throughout this talk is that in the first year of RUN, the initial spatial anisotropy in the geometry of non-central collisions has proven to be extremely useful in extracting information on the dynamical evolution of the system. So now we want to move away from momentum space and also try to use the same kind of effects to study the geometry of the system, which gives at the moment quite a puzzle to all different dynamical models that are employed to study heavy ion collisions. But as another introduction slide, some motivation why non-central collisions are of particular interest, just for just for geometrical reasons, you expect that by changing the centrality of the collision, you change the energy content in the system and the maximum energy in the center of the system. So I want you to see here those plots that I don't have to explain too much on those details. I just want you to see those things quantitatively, what happens. It is an actual global kind of calculation, and these things are all evaluated from geometrical reasons and some assumed proportionalities. But for the sake of the argument, you just see that with increasing the impact parameter, the energy density in the center of the system drops, and the temperature in the center of the system, of course, drops as well. Now, also, as you increase the impact parameter, you change the size of the system, just because the number of the wounded nucleon is decreasing with the impact parameter, and the number of the binary collisions you expect is decreasing with the impact parameter as well. So while on the one hand you can probe at a fixed beam energy, you can somewhat probe excitation functions of your system and of your observables, and therefore look for threshold effects already at fixed beam energy, but by systematically changing the impact parameter or classifying the collisions you produce with regards to the impact parameter, you might find good signals to classify, to see a threshold effect of a possible quark-gluon plasma. And here you might probe for volume effects, like how particles travel through the fireball that you have created. But most importantly for my talk here is that by non-central collisions, you also break the azimuthal symmetry that is inherent in central collisions. This is what I'm going to exploit in the following. And it is shown here, the centrality dependence, also the impact parameter, over and the spatial eccentricity, so the elongation in y's in the y axis, which is orthogonal to the reaction plane, over the x-axis, and you see that these systems get a larger and larger anisotropy as the impact parameter gets larger. So this is, for example, what we think the distribution of wounded nucleons looks like in the transverse plane if you have a finite impact parameter in the system. Here it's shown for 7 Fermi. Here you see the shadows of the incoming nuclei separated by this impact parameter of 7 Fermi. And the energy is deposited, or the wounded nucleons are produced according to Glauber kind of calculations, just relating the thicknesses of the penetrating nuclei. Then what I'm showing here are counters of constant wounded nucleon density. Now, of course, from such an initial configuration, you do expect effects which show an anisotropy with respect to this azimuthal angle phi. And if you believe that the system, if you assume for the moment, and I'm going to show the arguments later which validate this assumption, if you assume for the moment that the system is going to expand on a hydrodynamic basis, so that these are basically your pressure gradients stronger in the short direction than in the long direction, you expect also more matter to flow out and more violently to flow out in the short direction than in the long direction. Therefore, your particle distribution as a function of phi is going to show more particles emitted this direction than that direction. You make a Fourier analysis with respect to phi, and this first non-vanishing coefficient in the transverse plane is usually called elliptic flow, and is the one quantity that I already argued on the first slide was extremely useful to study the momentum evolution of the system. Now, if we assume such an initial configuration and put it into the hydrodynamic equation of motions, which I'm later on going to flash just for a second because I think everybody in here knows them. But if you let the hydrodynamics equation of motion work on such a system, you see at different time steps how the system just gets rounder because of the shorter pressure, stronger pressure gradients in this direction. So the anisotropy momentum space that is built up is really from the earliest stage. And in the end, the system is getting round, and the geometrical anisotropy might actually go to negative values, whereas here the y-axis is the preferred axis, more matter is in y direction, here more matter is along the x direction. So this detailed time evolution is shown here as a function of time. You see the spatial eccentricity that I have discussed before. You start out with a system elongated in y direction, and then as time evolves, it turns over actually to negative values at a time scale that we expect, where the system actually behaves hydrodynamically before it freezes out. Here you see the momentum anisotropy for different cases. I want you to focus on the blue line, which is corresponding to energies that, and entropy densities, which correspond to multiplicities observed at RIC. You see that.
What is RIC 1 versus RIC 2?
Well, that's the 130 GeV one, that's the 200 GeV one. You see that the momentum anisotropy builds up quickly, then it stalls because most of the matter is in the mixed phase and pressure gradients vanish. And by the time the system gets out of this mixed phase, the driving force, the geometrical anisotropy, has vanished, and the system just lingers around with the same momentum anisotropy until it freezes out here at those little triangles. I'll show you later, as kind of a punchline of the whole talk. you don't get a hole at RIC energies, but you get the hole for the LHC curves that I'm going to show. To take the punchline already out. I have more punchlines.
So can I make my usual comment that if you have something like a bank version of state, you have a latent universe idea on the tree that seems four times larger than pure blue theory alone, which Dirkhoff, we said, doesn't matter, just draw it as long as you smear it out. But then you just mentioned that you live a long time in the mixed phase, and that has some characteristic effect. So,
well, I'm living a long time in a soft phase where pressure gradients are small. That's
So if you say smearing it out has no dynamical consequence, then that means I can't use the data to differentiate.
It could be in first order, it could be in strong first order, or something that is more smooth, you cannot. It will never be able to read any data.
Can I differentiate between something that turns on very suddenly or turns on very slowly?
Yeah. Only by factor. But this very delicate process, I'm not sure that's the right. Well, that's something that we should actually work. I don't think that maybe this is something that evolves as a function of time, and you don't have a time differential measurement to see that anyway. So that's not argue about that. But there is something that survives when you look at the final elliptic flow as a function of beam energy, which also has a non-monotonicity. That's something that I think is non-monotonicity.
Did you already flash your equation of state?
No, it's the next slide. So Now I've shown you the results of the hydrodynamic calculations.
Is the OS1 curve?
That is ideal. I for ideal. That's okay. What it is. So that's the limit of tremendously high energy. So you see, turning up the energy from SPS to RIC, you get closer and closer to this ideal gas equation of state because its influence is going to be the largest. Because the system lives for the longest time with an equation of state where the energy density is a third of the pressure. The pressure is a third of the energy density. So everybody knows these equations, so I'm not going to talk a lot about them, but we solve energy momentum conservation and baryon number density conservation. And this is the equation of state, a connection between in the low energy density and a resonance gas, and at the high energy density and an ideal gas equation of state, which is connected via a critical temperature of 164 MeV, which is a parameter that we take from lattice calculations approximately, and we just connect them smoothly. We don't connect them smoothly, we connect them via a first order phase transition.
But that wouldn't make any difference. If you were to
it wouldn't make a large difference, but other people like Derek Tina and Edward Shuriak, they've been investigating in detail what we didn't do, what the influence is of the width of this latent heat.
Oh, the width of the latent heat could make a difference, but just smoothing it out into a...
No, that doesn't make a big difference.
Well, somebody should actually use that.
I'm sometimes thinking about it. Yeah.
Is the ratio of the latent heat to ideal energy?
To what?
To the ideal energy. To get it dimensionalized.
Well, the transition happens at 0.45 GeV per cubic Fermi. And just a collection of all the flow results. I think people know most of them. So I've just collected most of what we have on one slide to make the statement that most of the emitted particles, actually over 99% of the emitted particles, follow the systematics that we expect from hydrodynamics. Almost everything that you see here on these plots are predictions, and what we use to fit the parameters of before we make the system run and the hydrodynamic evolution start are those Phoenix data on pions, the transverse momentum particle distributions for pions and the slopes of the transverse momentum of the antiprotons for the most central bin, and then just for geometrical, how the system changes geometrically by choosing a larger impact parameter than zero, we get the other curves as prediction, which are subsequently scaled down by factors of 10 to make it visible, of course. Now, this thing basically exploits only the first two points that I've argued on the second slide, that the energy density in the system changes and the size of the system changes. Therefore, those slopes change as you go to more peripheral collisions and the particle yield changes. But more interestingly now is that also the coordinate anisotropy leads to flow anisotropies, here shown as a function of transverse momentum for three different centrality bins. And you see that we fit the most central data and the peripheral data rather well, and then we start losing the agreement in the more peripheral collisions, which is, of course, expected because the whole hydrodynamic picture relies on large energy densities, huge rescattering, and large volumes, so that this assumption of the hydrodynamic equilibration is actually valid. So going to larger impact parameters, of course, the whole description has to break down. The system is going to give us smaller flow than predicted by the hydrodynamic equations of motion. So this average bin corresponds to about 9 to 10 Fermi already. So this classification of centrality versus impact parameter is always strongly biased towards large impact parameter. When you see a number that sounds reasonably small in percent of the classification that experimentalists give, then it's always already a surprisingly large impact parameter, I find. You see it in some of the paper in the more recent papers, they actually give tables where they say this is approximately this and this impact parameter. And Note that this here happens on a very small scale of transverse momenta, whereas now the most recent results that have been published by Starr of strange particles go out to 3.5 GeV. It is at low momenta because that's all identified particles, right? And, oh, I should move to the side. And you see that also the strange particles follow the hydrodynamic systematics really up to an impact, up to transverse momenta of 2 GeV. This is averaged over all impact parameters in contrast to those differential results. So that is kind of a surprise, or not a surprise from the hydrodynamic picture, but from transport calculations. I think people expected that the strange results, the strange particles should drop out earlier and therefore have less flow. But hydrodynamics just says that the flow is built up early, and therefore all our particle species in the hydrodynamic picture get rather the same elliptic flow, except of some mass effect. So that this goes off slower than for the light particles is a pure mass effect of the heavier particles.
So that you would expect that if the strange particles freeze out earlier, they should get less radial flow.
That's the thing.
The same V2, but less radial flow.
If you integrate this curve then over the transverse momenta distribution, then the particles that freeze out early have steeper slopes and the transverse momentum, so they have stronger bias on lower PTs than the non-strange particles. And therefore, your PT integrated elliptic flow of particles that drop out early would be smaller.
So if they drop out earlier, there is no way to lower the PT. The PT is the differential flow.
Now at the workshop.
What is your attitude for, say, the number of pions below 200
PT? Well,
those up there, I think.
Does that become stronger as you go towards more central?
Now, the thing is that I think that it's maybe something with the resonances that we don't do right, because our
if it were resonances, wouldn't it show up as much in peripheral as central?
No, I don't think so, because in the central you produce more resonances, right? You produce more everything, so more resonances, so you miss.
So why do you produce more resonance? In thermal equilibrium, you produce some proportion, and that's, you know, that's right.
Well, one thing that our calculation does wrong is that it assumes chemical equilibrium all the way down to thermal.
Yeah, I'll come back to that later.
Of course, tell us that the chemical equilibrium is free. That means if you want to preserve the pion number at the level of 170 degrees temperature, the pion has to have a chemical potential at equivalently low. And that leads to a stronger population at low PT, and that may be explained by
that's the.
So you would say it's some kind of pion chemical.
That's the two effects. I didn't have the time to get to the second effect. But also note that this is 1 over PT in the particle distribution, right? So these particles in number are very, very small that we get wrong. So that's just what Uli said. Our pions are normalized as the data. That's one of our parameter. Our initial maximum entropy essentially is fitted to yield the particle, the pion, pion multiplicities in central collisions, and then we get because we assume thermal equilibrium down to 130 MeV to our thermal freeze out, we get too small number of protons. So these antiproton multiplicities that you see are scaled up by this factor that we get wrong. This is easily fixed, but not by us yet, but by other groups, by putting in chemical potentials which correct for that effect, which correct for chemical non-equilibrium. But that doesn't make a dynamical difference, right? All your equation of state and so on is not largely influenced. Your relation between energy density and pressure is not largely influenced. What is influenced is the relation between temperature and energy density. And that will be important, and there I have it on later slides. So now to show you the first new results from STAR, what was shown last week in Brookhaven, that was the strange particles at 200 GeV, but actually you see, so that's at 200 GeV beam energy, that's at 130 GeV, but you see that actually not much is changing, only that the systematic still fits with the hydro data. And here is a compilation, or that was presented by Yinghua Fu, I think. A compilation which really shows that the changes are little from 200 to, from 130 GeV, the crosses, to 200 GeV, the red dots.
Say that again. What is 200? What is 130?
The red dots are 200 GeV, and the crosses are 130 GeV. But what you see is the tremendous gain in statistics and the great results that we can expect in a month at Quark Matter. I don't remember that. Also, there were new results on. And before I argued that hydrodynamics is going to break down at large impact parameters, of course it's also going to break down at high PTs, because those high PT particles just fly out without rescattering too much and without knowing anything that is going on in the fireball. And there have been new results of charged elliptic flow at really high PTs out to almost 6 GeV. So these are the old results from 130 GeV, and now at 200 GeV you see those great data, and it looks just as before. There's not much changing except of the error bars. And we see finally this clear onset that elliptic flow is going down again at the highest transverse momenta, as is expected. From it's still not going down by much, and that's still another puzzle the community has. Why elliptic flow is actually still so large at those high
PT values? It's only going down for those very simple ones, where it's small in the first place. For the pink and red ones, it's hardly going down at all.
I mean, the point is that we finally see that it's going down, but it's not going down by much. Anyway, of course, there was also a talk by Yuri Kovkigov, who says he has all that under control from a theoretical kind of view, but I'm not going to elaborate on this. I think you had a talk here about it. So just to summarize now in words what I showed before in these compilations of experimental results versus hydrodynamic results, we see that in the data that we have really large transverse flow with average velocities of around 0.5 C at decoupling. And we have to have a rapidly thermalizing system, because this initial spatial anisotropy that is driving the evolution of the anisotropies in the flow, if we wait for a long enough time, then the system just gets dilute and the initial cause of anisotropies vanishes. Therefore, we have to employ an equilibration time of 0.6 Fermi over C at temperatures of 340 MeVs, thus penetrating far into the transition region of our equation of state, and what we expect from lattice that where the transition occurs at around 170 MeV. And then I've said all that before.
May I ask a question? The latest analysis from STAR says that perhaps 15% of the flow that you showed is non, of the V2 is actually not flow, but the V1. So if the real flow contribution were only 85%
of the actual so far. Do you have a feeling of how much feeling that gives you for shifting time to get that? I think we cannot say very much about that yet, because when we call flow an elliptic flow, we really calculate the anisotropies that I've shown, this definition that I've shown before, and we do not care whether these are flow effects or non-flow effects. It is just this quantity is defined as flow, as it was in the old Olicho paper. And now
we cannot calculate the inject quantity.
And now there are these discussions, what is actually flow? And I think there is quite a confusion still in the whole community. Of course, out at 6 GeV, that isn't flow effects anymore, but it's called flow, right? Sometimes people say it's non-flow flow.
So the analysis is right, and that the collective contribution to V2 is only 85% of what they have shown so far. So in order to get agreement then with the hydro, you would have to lower the hydro by 15% to the slope of 15%. Do you have a feeling of what we would have to do because they're in the
If it does anything, it does get larger, but I think it wouldn't get over one Fermi over C. It's a belief that I don't have proof of, yeah. Because I think it's not a big effect. And what I'm going, all our calculations were done with a lot of care. I'm not sure if I mentioned it in the beginning. Of course, most of the stuff I did was with Uli Heinz. And we took great care in calculating the contributions of resonances and so on. That is, of course, also a non-flow effect, that the resonances dilute your elliptic flow signal. And now we have to go through that whole procedure because the star people think, and Oli Tru and collaborators think, that with their new analysis methods, whether those four cumulants methods, all these effects are thrown out and are negligible. Well, they just drop out of the analysis. But then the discussion is still going because Yuri shows examples where he says this definitely is not true, and so we have to wait for a couple of weeks to see how this field develops.
Was
I think.
Johnny,
Oli Tru Anyway, now I want to make the leap going from all those momentums.
It would be interesting to put Yuri and Johnny in a small room for a few days and see what comes out.
But physically, it's an easy way. It's a correlation to the reaction side.
The only way you could see the reaction side is by measuring the reaction.
Well,
we're
doing that on the flow. And then say, take the reaction side and flip it by 90 degrees. That's an estimate.
Yeah, well, if you had an independent measure of the reaction time, this discussion wouldn't be happening.
Can I ask you about your colleague at Ohio State who takes a fairly neutronic gas and puts everything?
Oh, I'll come back to that later as well.
But so why should I be finding it as a strong plate? He does it with the resonance gas.
Exactly, that's what I wanted to say. You. Exactly. That was one big discussion at Brookhaven as well. Like Pavel was strongly intervening and said he did that kind of calculations a couple of years ago and found that there are big numerical difficulties showing up. So did Dennis. And I think whenever we do model calculations and want to learn something from the model, we should have a reasonable model that is underlying the whole procedure that you're looking at. So I think these calculations are more intuitive because it takes input from stuff we know from lattice and so on,
so
and from intuition.
Your equation
makes you happy. Make you happy. They're trying to take that.
How long was the Japanese?
The Japanese guys, they. My calculation is all boost invariant, right? So I. Mm-hmm, that's what we do, and then we find, because our calculations are simpler, so therefore, I hope nobody watches this on TV, therefore we are always a little bit faster and the Japanese are catching up and do everything at a finite rapidity then. And and it turned out that they always just confirmed our results at finite rapidity, at zero rapidity, and they just give the expansion to finite eta. That's how it is. Also, our calculation is rather free of a lot of ambiguities, and if they want to initialize their calculations, especially with non-central collisions, they get a lot of ambiguities in initializing the initial distribution of matter
along the
beam axis. Yeah.
Oh, I don't see how they just make up initial distribution, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what else can
you
do?
Exactly.
So you gotta make up.
Exactly, and at some eta it breaks down anyway, and the Japanese calculations are nice to see that there is a width of -1.5 or -2 to 2 where you see that the system looks really boost invariant. I'll come back to that later too. Nothing new. Well, that's another thing. Of course, your hydro breaks down at some rapidity as well, so you can't just pull it out to beam eta.
Yeah, but something approved that between the minds of half and a half, one everything.
Yeah, and identified is really even p's and p bars and about half a unit. And I think pions is like 3/4 plus or minus 3/4 of a unit. And it really does look, I mean, even p's and p bars is surprising because there is a net excess, right? And but they both look black.
Yeah. Anyway, I want to make the leap from momentum to coordinates now to keep up with my promise that we want to investigate coordinate information. But first I have to talk about coordinates information from central collisions. And therefore now, for a moment, I go back to B equals zero and look at how my source, my hydrodynamic source, actually emits particles in space and time. So here, this is the source function which holds the information where in space and time particles of which momenta are emitted. So this is just this integral over the freeze-out hypersurface implemented with a delta function, so that this function is defined at all momenta, but it has finite values at all space-time coordinates, but it has values only on stuff that is actually on the freeze-out hypersurface sigma. And every cell of the freeze-out hypersurface shines particles out according to their statistical factor, boosted by a certain flow velocity that is the result of our hydro calculation. Now, if I integrate this whole information over all of four space, then I am left over with the momentum information, the particle distribution of the particles that I want to investigate. Also in the following, I'm now only investigating the thermal emission of pions without any resonance contributions. Now, if I don't do this integration over all of space-time, but only over two coordinates, I'm left with a distribution in the remaining two coordinates, and this is useful to really see where particles are emitted. So I do this exercise here, fixing the transverse momentum for two different values so I get a better feeling, and integrating out the longitudinal and the time coordinate, for example, in the upper two pictures, and the one radial component and the longitudinal coordinate to get a picture in radial distance and time where particles are emitted for the two different momenta. So of course, in this case, everything is symmetric and particles are emitted azimuthally symmetric. But if I switch on a finite momentum with a K-perp looking along the x direction, I see that most particles stem from a region where the radial flow is large and where the radial flow goes into the direction of the momentum that I'm looking at. So then you see this question shape strongly pressed to the system's largest expansion. Okay. And then we want to know, so actually at which times are those momenta, are those particles emitted? Therefore, we integrate, as I said before, over one radial coordinate and over the longitudinal coordinate. And then we see that those particles are emitted rather late when the fireball shrinks back inwards. These dashed lines show the maximum extent of the fireball as it evolves in time. That's the freeze-out hypersurface. And finite momenta are apparently particles with finite momentum are apparently emitted when the system is at its largest expansion, because the radial flow profile, which increases almost linearly as time evolves linearly also in the radial direction, is largest out here. But you see that we have strong contributions from late times, even though the everything has been frozen out and the hypersurface reaches down to the center. There are in the transverse plane, there are contributions from finite eta which contribute to particle emission at later time. So if that was not clear enough, it gets clear in these pictures where I integrate out the two radial coordinates to show particle emission in the longitudinal coordinate in time. And you see there are these big boost horns forming those hyperbolia, which are the longer, the later the freeze-out time is. This is an effect because the longitudinal flow field, this boost Bjorkman flow field that we have built in our equations is Vc is equal to c over t. So the gradient in the longitudinal direction over c is 1 over t. So the gradient, if everything happens late, 1 over t, this gradient is going to be small if everything happens late, and the collective velocity is going to be small. Therefore, contributions where the random thermal velocity counterbalance this collective velocity, this can happen at larger c's than if everything happens early and your longitudinal flow gradient is large. So this is why this delta t width is related to the freeze-out time. Now, there is this geometrical relation between the HBT radii and the source, which tells you that the HBT radii are actually a convolution in an idealized case, are a convolution of those widths of the emission regions. So what I'm going to call mean y squared in the following, that is, for example, this width of this crescent, and mean x is this width. Here you have a mean t squared and a mean x squared. So these are those quantities carry tildes on their tops because I'm addressing the variances of these emission regions, the widths of these emission regions. Now, if these sources, if these things that I'm plotting there in very much detail would be easy to approximate by Gaussian emission regions, then these things would be directly related to the outside and long radii measured by experimentalists. Okay, and this is where all the trouble starts. The black lines are the results of our hydro calculations, which gave this fantastic result to describe the momentum spectra and all the momentum observables. And now looking at these geometrical estimates and comparing them with the geometrical estimates extracted from experiments, from the star experiment and from the Phoenix experiment, which actually really combine and show that experimentalists have their results under control and know what they are doing, we see that in hydrodynamics something is going wrong. The outward radius, which couples spatial information with time information, is too large. The sideward radius, which is a pure measure of this width of my crescent, of the height of my crescent, is too small. So somehow the system looks too small. And this longitudinal radius, measuring the width along the beam axis, which I argued is related to the freeze-out time, is too large. Now, it looks like the system lives too long, as I argued before, and like it doesn't blow up enough because that is too small. Therefore, we investigated the initial stage of the collision and thought about mechanisms that would make the system blow up more rapidly. And usually, traditionally, those hydrodynamic calculations are initialized with zero flow field. Now, we've put in some rather drastic initial flow fields already to just see what the changes are, and you see, in fact, the system freezes out earlier. Therefore, this goes down, but not by too much, and the system's size stays pretty much the same. And only just for fun, we checked, more or less for fun, we checked what our results look like if we already assume that the correlations are happening at the hadronization temperature, and then we see at least the lifetime would be in rather good shape, and therefore also the outward radius, but still then the geometry, the size of the fireball is of course completely wrong. Now, one point and some news on what was shown at the meeting at BNL, but I was not allowed to show the original transparency, so I made it up from what I had in my notes, so don't take that too seriously anymore. But there have been first results on strange particles, on kaons, and on especially important on neutral particles, on K0s. Because this is important because here we might have all the corrections under better control, like the Coulomb correction drops out and so on, and also the influence of the resonances gets smaller. Here you see that those radii actually fall right onto the transverse mass systematics of the pions, those outside in long radius. And however, this K0 radius was surprisingly large. Also, the analysis of non-identical particle correlations is getting more and more important and is going to hold.
This K0 radius is
a... That's just a one-dimensional fit for practice. But it's coming up, that's what I mean.
Is that expected to be as small as the other one? I mean, that has all these kinematic factors in there. It's not good, but that's really important.
In a naive thermal picture, I would say it should just come out like all the other particles and have the same radius. But it probably doesn't because it's a rather strange particle, right?
I mean, when you see what is multiplying this factor in the exponent, it's Q invariant, which has velocity factors in there. So it's not clear that it could be actually have the same radius.
Yeah. Anyway, what is nice if you take those K plus and K minus radii and put it in there with the experimental radii, it falls right on, it falls right into the line and into the systematics. So,
yeah.
I think there's somewhere. I don't remember because this information wasn't on the web anymore, and that's just what I had in my notes. And what I remember was...
I don't understand your step. What line does it fall on?
If you convert this to M-perp, and then you put these as K-perp in here in the momentum bin that they were measured, which I think was 0.2, 2.4 GeV, then it falls somewhere right on here. So you can make a smooth curve through there. That's what I... It was such a nice plot that I remembered it, but wasn't quick enough to copy it because it was also promised it would be on the web on Monday. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Well, anyway, before you pick that up, can you say again, right? Can you say again what you did to make the dotted line was hydro plus
E-crit? That's just like evaluating everything not at a freezer temperature of 130 MeV, where we think the hydro evolution stops, but 165 before matter comes out from the mixed phase to form the hadronic phase.
You just ignore the hadronic phase.
Yeah.
Which, of course, would screw up the single particle spin.
Of course. Yeah. So, but that's the problem, and that's what lots of people work on. And here is a collection of some theorists who were there at the meeting. Now, people look at, maybe we do something wrong in the hadronic stage, maybe it's something in the expansion dynamics that we don't treat correctly, or maybe it's that these questions and so on that I showed have such strong non-Gaussian features. But go through it one by one. Svensov argued or tried to modify his hadronic equation of state by including resonance, the effect of the medium on resonances, like broadening of the row and mass shifts. Then Tetsu Hirano and Derek Tine, they have been arguing on this chemical non-equilibrium, and this actually brings in an effect that at a certain energy density, your temperature is lower, right? And therefore, this just corresponds to switching off, to not changing the dynamics, but that your system freezes out earlier because at a certain energy density, your temperature is already lower. And this is why Tetsu's data actually look pretty much exactly like our dotted line in here. Just because his hydro evolution stops earlier. But then he has different temperatures.
He fixes the freeze-out temperature from the single particle slope.
Mm-hmm, that's still the same.
Temperature corresponds to a higher energy density, mm-hmm. So that is reached earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But
now,
it cannot be the plate condition.
Of course he has a different temperature then. He has a smaller temperature. And Tetsu says he describes the spectra well, and Derek says, when I talked to him in his office, that if he can't describe the spectra so well anymore. So I probably have to check myself what is going on if I include effects like that. And other arguments is that just the transition to hadrons is a highly viscous transition, and those effects might give you earlier freeze out.
Can you explain why, I mean, you can imagine that these kinds of effects might change the HPT, but why wouldn't they spoil all of the other beautiful agreements?
That's a very good question.
I mean, if you stick in viscosity in the hadrons, that should affect, well, not V2 because V2 is early, but it should affect all the single particles.
Yeah. Well, actually, that is what Derek told me, and there are publications on this. There are publications on all those things out now, except of Sven's work. But I don't remember what they're writing about the single particle spectra. Of course, it's important that you still fit everything, and just by wanting to fit the HPT, you don't screw up what you did so beautifully before.
Right.
But I think everybody keeps that in mind. I can't say more about that.
Okay. I mean, are the people up in that top category, are they claiming victory? Are they claiming that they've solved the problem?
No, because even those medium modifications that Sven tries to put in gives effect that goes in the right direction, but not effects large enough. Then in their hadronic rescattering stage, they don't have such a large problem with the outward radius, with the sideward radius due to this long hadronic rescattering anyway. But they also have a big, big lifetime problem. Their longitudinal radius is much too large. Okay, we'll get to that. Well, then there have been arguments like Dirk saying that maybe we shouldn't consider only boost invariant sources, but rather put in some different longitudinal flow profile with alpha something that is smaller than 1, which leads to a stronger transverse expansion and therefore to a stronger transverse dynamics, therefore also to earlier freeze out and maybe larger radii and maybe some mushroom shape. And I have already been discussing pre-equilibrium dynamical effects and initial flow fields, which also didn't give enough of an effect. And Uli Heinz and Stephen Wong had a paper recently on viscosity effects.
Pre-equilibrium dynamically just means starting it off with an initial
flow profile, not just generating all of the flow in the hydroevolution, but also already starting the hydroevolution with some radial flow profile.
And that's not enough.
I mean, if you allow yourself a lot of freedom to choose initial.
Well, I stayed within reasonable estimates for this initial flow profile.
You still can't get HPT.
No.
Exactly.
No. And then Uli Heinz and Stephen Wong had a reduced longitudinal pressure throughout the evolution of the system, but that completely screwed up the particle spectra, and also doesn't give you big enough effect in your sideward radius, right? At least when I looked at your freeze-out hypersurface, that was just at the same radial distances stuck then in the old calculation.
The momentum state part came out completely wrong at fixed slopes with single particle spectra, we get only half.
Okay, then maybe I put on a transparency later on this argument that the regions of homogeneity are actually strongly non-Gaussian. I might have time for that. And then there is Tommy Manick, who says everything works out rather fine if you just assume that you have a resonance gas at 300 MeV and let them rescatter. But there have been strong discussions that maybe something in his calculation is not so good. And even though the model describes everything rather nicely, he has difficulties to convince people that the model makes sense at all. And Thomas Jörge and André Stier, they argue on some kind of inflationary model that everything just blows up very quickly and freezes out in no time at all. But this short time period is just because of the time dilation and longitudinal direction and particle emission out from the longitudinal direction and still contributing to particles with y equals 0 with vanishing longitudinal momentum. From this argument, I think such an emission duration, even though it fits the data, lacks any physical reason to any physical description.
What's the physics of this idea? What
of their idea?
Yeah.
That it's an analytic solution of the equations of motions. And, pardon?
Which is already suspicious.
And that it is so nice, it's such a nice comparison to the Big Bang and just how the whole world happened.
What's blowing it out? Inflation is driven by a vacuum term.
They don't do a dynamic of the loop.
No, this is just a fit.
They take a model function which is motivated by this inflationary explosion idea, and then they fit the parameters in that model function to the data, right? So it's similar experience to the MyFISA fit with the bath weight model, but it's a different model. And they are interacting with the same problem. If you want to fit the data, you have to essentially assume instantaneous freeze-out mode steps.
In particular, what changed with respect to their last publication in whatever January or December, they now included also the Phoenix HPT radii in their fit, and therefore their freeze-out temperature, their fitting temperature that they need is even larger than before, around 200 MeV and tremendously large flow velocities.
Should I take a person with lost weight? Should not think about it at all.
How much time do I still have?
Of all the things you just covered, which is
yeah, that's a good question. Of all the things that you just listed, which is worth actually thinking about? I mean, I'm interested in number three. How important is the non-Gaussianity of the home?
Okay, then I show those slides. I was wondering if I ran out of time. How much time do I have still?
Well, I'm going to do part.
We started late, so at least 10 minutes.
Oh!
No. let's not give them that. Don't go crazy.
Do what you were hoping to do.
Okay, then about this non-Gaussian freeze-out emission reason.
My attitude is rather radical in that respect. I mean, you can parameterize the data, of course, with all kinds of models, but in the end,
A model with some parameters in it that describes the final state, and then you fit the parameters in your description of the final state.
So that's what's true and true.
This is generically some kind of shock or blast that's going to increase the HPT radius.
Well, because the HPT radius measures the width of the emission, not the total size. So even with the shock, you get this phenomenon that everything gets squeezed to the edge where the flow is larger, and therefore the width is small. And this amplified which works for the same reason.
I don't know what shock solution you have in mind. Well, I don't have it. I was not able to generate any shock which goes under the motion shift of data. No, there is no emission condition. No standard emission condition. That's why we have to find the standard scenario, but in a reasonable way. I'm just assuming that inflation doesn't really solve the problem. There's no reasonable condition which will give you an inflation like for every component.
When you look at their analytical solution, it's a solution to the pressureless quark law, which is a solution to the big thing.
So I'm trying to step back. If you don't believe these models, that's fine. I'm just asking generically, going in the direction of an extreme blast or shock wave, does it help to reconcile
an explosion?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm reading from this, at a distance without having gone into the model.
Yeah, I mean, it helps and it doesn't. It helps because it brings the lifetime down. It makes the disagreement with the HPT radii smaller, but you can't get it at the price of keeping the single particle right.
At least within the model.
Well, so as the data.
Okay.
I wouldn't dare to exclude it, but so far.
Yeah, go ahead. So now, what I said before, you see that there are strong non-Gaussian features in these emission regions. And Now, what I want to do is not to evaluate my parameters only from the geometrical arguments, but really go into the detailed calculation, how it's usually done, that you take a convolution of your Friesshardt hypersurface of two points on the Friesshardt hypersurface, which have their statistical factors and which are convoluted by the phase in between, normalized over the individual single particle spectra. So this is the quantity that goes from 2 when the things are strongly correlated at small q, and which goes down to 1 when there is no correlation at all, and this thing upstairs just factorizes to give the same as in the denominator. So therefore, because I want to have a quantity that is bound by 1 and 0, I subtract 1, and this is what I'm going to call correlator in the following, this R.
We have 2 minutes on missing down
for you. Okay, that's right. Now, I do that in the following just to see what happens. I set 2 of those q's 0 and make a function for k as a parameter as a function of the other remaining q. So that's what you see here, q for the out and for the side direction with k perp as a parameter. And these are these correlators that I'm getting. They look somewhat Gaussian, but to show you that they're not quite Gaussian, there is this dashed line here, which really is a Gaussian with the parameter that I extract from the geometrical arguments I've shown before. Now, if you go to the longitudinal direction, setting q out, q side 0, and examine what happens longitudinally, you see still things, the red lines, which are somewhat Gaussian, but then overlaying a real Gaussian, again, with the r squared as extracted from the geometrical estimate, you see that there are rather strong deviations going on at small q. Now, this is better visible if I take... At very small q, it's fine, but then going to larger q, it's getting worse and worse. It's just you don't see it here anymore, that it's getting actually still worse. Therefore, I make this plot logarithmically here to eliminate the e, and I plot it versus q squared, so the remaining result, if it really were a Gaussian, would be a straight line with r out squared as the slope. So I just take those two plots again, take the logarithm and plot them versus q squared. And that's what you get here. What was before the Gaussians, now are straight lines, as I said. And you see the strong deviations for the side radius. It's getting worse and more interesting for the out radius. So here are actually bumps in this curve. This is why this goes down to minus infinity, because it hits 0 already and goes up again. This is known from sources that have a strong cutoff at some radial distance, just like our Friesshardt hypersurface actually has. And you see that there is really an outrageous difference for the longitudinal direction. Those curves that we evaluate from the boost invariant source are anything else but the Gaussian lines. The Gaussian lines are just the slopes at q equals 0 to our lines. So if we are just investigating this, and it's still under development. But if the experimental thing is that they extract the radius or the slope of this curve at some finite q squared or in a finite interval of q squared, they're going to fit lines or segments on a curve which is maybe not a Gaussian at all, but something like this. So therefore, you have like this. So then you're... The r squared that you extract from such data is, of course, much smaller than the r squared that you extract from the tangent. And maybe this is one more reason why the experimental results are low compared to any dynamical calculations.
You can also look at it differently. When you look at the top graph and you realize that in the experiments you don't have data at very small because of momentum resolution.
Yeah, and all the correction effects make it difficult too.
By a Gaussian coming from the large Q region, and they leave the intercept free, you can see that you can fit to those red curves Gaussians, which are considerably smaller radii, by paying for it with a smaller intercept. Because that's what they do.
That's what the experimentalists do.
Where it is much better.
that's one dimension of it, we were
Are you sure that when you show those powers?
No, what the experimentalist fit is, yes. The experiment.
Forget what they fit to, but the data.
My results? What my results are?
No, the data look roughly like this. Yeah, and you cannot really, by just looking roughly on it, you cannot distinguish between
and the red curve, much like my point is, if you do then fit, and in particular if you leave the intercept free, if you have such deviations from small, apparently small deviations from the Gaussian, that can drive your fitness to a different corner.
Rob, I think, I mean, the point they're making.
I'm asking, so why do they fit more general functions? We have no reason to tell them to start the Gaussian. So why don't
we do have to?
Why is it Gaussian?
Certainly at Q is 0, it has to be a Gaussian. That's not helpful because they don't have data there.
When Q is 0, it's not. How do you know it's Gaussian? Well, from we know it's a Gaussian.
If Q equals 0, the only thing that matters is the RMS.
No, if Q in general, it's not Q equals 0. We know it's a Gaussian in the region where...
That's the mathematics. If you analyze what the Fourier transform translates to a small Q, it's a Gaussian.
The thing is that...
What do you mean by a power? How can you put a power to that curve? It has a wiggle.
I mean, I heard a talk from guy in L3, E plus E minus. Yeah, I know that. He says he gets the best isolation from power.
I know, but that's meaningless statement. Yeah, because what they do is they fit the invariant correlation function, which is a projection of what should be a Gaussian over various components. It looks no longer Gaussian, and then they take the power out of thin air, fit it to it.
But Rob has a point, because you don't see that turnover composition. I mean, I don't have any data about the
Do you have any correlation function data or transparency?
Nope.
Okay, the point of this plot is that it's roughly a Gaussian, but it's not really a Gaussian.
Yeah, and it makes a big difference on your fitting procedure.
That given that it's not really a Gaussian, and given that, you know, when the experimentalists quote an R out and an R side, they're doing a Gaussian fit to data which can't, you know, which is not perfectly Gaussian. And when you quote an R out and R side, you are doing a different Gaussian fit to curves that aren't Gaussian. And, you know, you guys have to figure out how to be comparing apples to apples instead of apples to oranges.
That's what we're about to do.
If you're all going to do Gaussian fits, it's fine as long as you're all doing them the same way.
But we just didn't know that the effect would be so big.
Yeah. Yesterday, I received finally a response from my team, which explained exactly how they fix the correlation. So now we are going to do, we're trying to repeat exactly the same steps on the correlation function that we have generated here.
But I still have an entire talk to go through, because now I promised you that we want to extract this, to use all this for non-central collisions as well. So now I'm looking at my source function again for non-central collisions. So the impact parameter is fixed to 7 Fermi, and I integrate out longitudinal and time coordinate again to show the distribution in x and y. Here for k perp equals 0, that's again where particles are emitted from the central regions, where flow is smallest. But then if I want to look at particle emissions with finite momenta from different angles phi, then I see how this question just shifts around with the momentum that I want to observe. And you see how these widths in here change in the most interesting way. So here, this width of the questioned in direction of observation, which is related to the outward radius, is small because the flow gradient in this direction is so large. When I turn around with phi, then the flow gradient in this long direction is smaller because here the pressure gradients were smaller to start off with. Therefore, this whole width is bigger too. Oh, you told me I should point here, right? So this whole width is bigger than here. Because of the smaller flow in the out of plane direction, I should say, On the other hand, I can't do it really here to make my point. On the other hand, this sideward direction, sideward with respect to the direction of observation, is larger seen from this way because of the geometrical bonds this fireball sets on me. Therefore, as I go around with phi, this direction orthogonal to the momentum is decreasing. Now, there is a formalism to set up which tells you how to evaluate the oscillation of the HPT radii from rotating the system. This was given by Wils Wiedemann 4 years. This was worked out by Wils Wiedemann 4 years ago. And the thing is, just to say it in a sentence, you want to calculate the outward radius as you turn around the source. Therefore, you look at the source function, the source function. You look at the spatial correlation tensor, which gives you this variances. S mu nu is the variance in x times the variance in nu in the average of it. And you have to rotate this quantity around towards the direction of observation. Therefore, this S mu nu that I just showed has an implicit dependence depending on the phi you observe it, but then you have to rotate it explicitly into the direction of observation. That's why, in addition to an implicit dependence of the SXX, there is an explicit dependence of this phi. So that's just technical details that has been worked out and that we are employing. And then we see that it's really just like I said, the sideward radius is larger seen from phi equals zero. The sideward radius is larger seen from phi equals zero. Here is phi. And as we go to phi I cross p half, the sideward radius decreases. The outward direction, as I just said, increases because of the geometrical, because of the flow reasons. Interesting is the R outside, it just oscillates around. It will be interesting in a minute. So this is not just a game that I'm playing here. There are serious data coming out, which Randy presented for the STAR collaboration at the BNL meeting. You see those oscillations, they do exactly the same thing as I said. The outward radius oscillates upwards and then down again. The sideward goes down and the outside oscillates up and then down again.
Outside.
That contains most important term in outside to know is this SYY minus XX. So it shows you how the ellipsoid actually rotates around with phi.
We can understand the sign of ourselves by a tilt angle between the original ellipsoid and the direction.
Now this whole analysis is still new, but it's getting there to be really exploited. But of course, because it's new, there is some controversy building up. What is it actually that is observed? Is this a clear indication of the geometry, or are we fooled that we don't really see the geometry, but that what we see are those regions of homogeneity? So is it really that we are here seeing an ellipsoid that is tilted out of plane, or are we seeing those emission homogeneity regions which are out of plane in our case anyway? But in one of the first transparencies, I have shown how the spatial geometry changes from positive values to negative values as time evolves. And for the Rick calculations, you see that the freeze-out occurs at a time where this has just reached negative values. The particle emission stems from regions which are late, but where the emission is still, where the geometry is still out of plane. If we go to higher energies, then we see we already live at much earlier times at negative energy density, at negative spatial eccentricity. And now I want to see what the effects on the oscillations are in this case. Therefore, I show you one last plot of the source function for the calculations that I've investigated so far. The Rick calculations for 7 Fermi, here integrated also over transverse momenta. Therefore, the particle emission is highest in those regions outside. Now I don't have questions anymore because I integrate all of the transverse momenta. So this is just the sum of all the questions that I've shown before. And you see this bathtub structure because the rim is higher here in the middle and in the interior it's depleted. If you go to very high energies, the system lives long enough in the in-plane direction, and this bathtub is just elongated in the other direction. Now, as you've learned from the pictures before, looking at small K-perps, we really investigate the interior of the region, and we investigate an ellipsoid that is out of plane in this case and in plane in the other case. And moving over to higher K-perps, with K-perp, for example, elongated with the particle emission in X direction, we see how those ellipsoids are squeezed out to the rim of the system. And now here's the big change that occurs. Whereas in both cases, these homogeneity regions are elongated out of plane, in this case, it changes from an in-plane elongation to an out-of-plane elongation when we go to high enough K-perps. That's my initial time, and tau zero, that's my initial temperature in the system, and that's my time when I start the hydroevolution. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a daring point, but interesting. Yeah.
It's at the BLHC.
Anyway, you see this drastic difference in the two cases. And you also see, to come back to your questions, the question that you asked much earlier, how the effect on the freeze-out hypersurface is. Whereas a trick, so this shows the freeze-out hypersurface in X or in Y direction, one setting Y equals to 0, one setting X equals 0. At the initial time, you see that the system is larger in Y than in X. It's out of plane. And then as time evolves, the direction X wins over the Y. And then the in-plane elongated source, this is much more drastic. The system blows just up in X direction. It also blows up in Y direction, but not quite as much.
Yeah, but what's the plot? What are the answers?
You didn't label the X.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the other direction. So this is the radial direction.
This is freeze-out time versus space, right?
And this is the time. So you see, as time evolves, in-plane elongated source. That's the LHC case.
So it's LHC with
Yeah.
No, it's VLHC.
Anyway.
Very large
Is it clear now what this plot says, or should I go in more detail still?
Show the other thing and show.
So, this curve shows at y equals 0, a cut through here, how the system evolves in time. It shows the motion of this freeze-out hypersurface in the third dimension, how it moves in time. That's the third dimension that is missing in this plot. And in the same for y equals 0. And this is for the out-of-plane, for the in-plane elongated source. Also for y equals 0, the solid line, that's the thing that just blows up to large radii out here. Whereas for x equals 0 in y direction, it doesn't blow up so large. And then you see also, if I make a slice of equal time through here for people who know about these calculations, then you see everything has left in y direction. There is a hole in y direction where there is still matter in x direction. So here you clearly see an effect that was called nutcracker by Derek Tina and Edward Shuriak. They predicted it would, they hoped it would happen at RIC already, but pardon? I don't know if Landau did non-central collisions, but it's a clear... This nutcracker thing is a clear feature of non-central collisions, of course, because it breaks the azimuthal symmetry. Well, I think what has been seen is that is that a mushroom anymore?
Dirk, you sound like Edward.
Anyway.
No, I don't think it's a fair statement here, because the nutshell phenomenon relies on the difference in X and Y. What you're referring to is that this type of shape, generic shape,
exactly. What you're referring to is only the solid lane. And the new thing is the solid and dashed lane. Well, anyway, that is just not what my time is for here.
Well, usually thought that you had actually a lump in the middle, okay? And then it was pointed out it's actually the hole in the middle, okay? There's no nuggets in it. Now it's only a fraction.
Okay, but because of these arguments, I said you should expect a change of this whole oscillation phenomena by changing your transverse momentum of the phi dependence of the HPT radii that I argued. And here are the results of the actual calculation. This is what you've seen before, the oscillations at RIC, whereas the other curve are the results for the Very Large Hadron Collider. And you see K perp equals zero. It really oscillates in the opposite direction for the side and for the out, and increasing K perp, the oscillations become as you've seen them at the RIC, because you don't measure really the geometry of the fireball anymore. You don't measure the in-plane elongated source, but you're measuring the regions of homogeneity of the in-plane elongated source. It is not quite as simple as that, but for the moment that's enough to remember. But there is a big contribution coming in this just in this R outside term that I've written down before. When you look at Urs's paper, you see how to evaluate this and how the temporal components actually play an important role in the oscillations. What the thin lines in this plot show, the pure geometrical contribution to the total R outside, and you see that the geometrical contribution is always on the negative side for those K-perps that I'm investigating. And the reason why this R outside oscillation changes sign at rather small K-perps is then purely due to this temporal part where the time-space correlation enters. But important anyway to keep in mind is that there is a change in the sign of oscillations at transverse momenta, which are actually the transverse momenta that are usually accessible within such experiments. And then I want to finish and just put on this slide to summarize. I want to stress again that the centrality, that dependencies of centrality are a great tool to study all kinds of effects, maybe also threshold effects. And that the anisotropic observables and their dependencies tell us a lot about the collective dynamics and hopefully also about the geometry of the system. Understanding of the differences between dynamical calculations and the measurements in HPT is just emerging, and we are probably soon there to have it resolved. And then I talked about the azimuthal oscillations of the HPT radii. Okay, thanks.